From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jackie Lydon in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A team of scientists has decoded the genome of the house cat. One big takeaway, your fuzzy tabby is still mostly a wild animal, a lion-hearted puss. That might not be a huge surprise to the world's cat owners, who are probably familiar with Muffy or Fluffy's independent, dare I say, mean streak, but the genetic details the study unlocked can help shed light on the history and behavior of the Internet's most viewed pet and their human companions. This hour on Point, deciphering the kitty code and yours. You can join us on air online. Are you a cat owner, a cat lover, a cat hater? What do you want to know about what goes on inside a cat's head or heart? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org on Twitter and Facebook. And later this hour, we'll hear the story of a cat that helped a family heal after losing a loved one. But first, joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Michael Montague, researcher at the Genome Institute at Washington University in St. Louis, and lead author on the study that analyzed the genome of the domestic cat. Mike Montague, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jackie. It's nice to be here.
Just in time, I guess, for The Cat in the Hat Comes Back.
Exactly.
I don't know if he was wild though, or domesticated. But in all seriousness, you spent years sequencing the genome of the house cat. And I suppose the first question is why you did.
Well, right. The first draft assembly of the cat genome was completed back in 2007. And this genome was very fragmented and incomplete. So we improved this genome assembly, and that allowed us to look more closely at specific genes in the cat genome and compare these genes with those in other organisms, including the human genome, the dog, the tiger, the cow, different wild cats, and also a number of different domestic cat breeds.
And in all seriousness, what do we need to know? Why do we need to know from this sequencing? What can we learn about our human diseases and genome sequencing?
Well, cats have specific sets of diseases, some of which are related to human diseases. As a genome scientist and comparative biologist, we're consistently striving to improve the reference genome assemblies for organisms of interest in order to just improve our resolution of biological change over time and also to get a greater understanding of where we are and how to improve our own health.
Now, how did you do this exactly? Because you found that, if I can paraphrase, that cats essentially have hung on to a lot more of their wild traits than, say, canines have. So maybe you could talk about those traits and why they are still in evidence even in house cats.
Well, one interesting example is the way that domestic cats have retained their ability to detect pheromones. These are social communication signals that are shared between different cats. So they have a higher number of functional genes that code for these receptors. And dogs have lost a greater number of these receptors in their own genome. So we hypothesize that dogs are more reliant on their sense of smell, and cats are more reliant on their sense of detecting these pheromones for social signals. And so that's one specific example about the sociality of dogs and how cats are more solitary in the wild.
Does that mean that over time cats are going to become more responsive to their companions, I didn't even say owners, commands? Because cats can seem so indifferent. You know, the famous cartoon, What We Say to Cats, this is a Larson, what they hear, and there's a little blank cloud over the cat's head.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a good question. Dogs have certainly been bred for specific behavior, task-oriented behaviors such as hunting and herding and security, and they're useful as companion animals for different types of people. And cats haven't really been bred for that, for those sorts of reasons. So cats are good hunters, of course. We suspect they were good at capturing rodents around these ancient grain storage during the time of agricultural development in the Near East. And so they've retained these sorts of hunting abilities, but we don't see many other behavioral task-oriented traits in different cat breeds.
I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that there's a greater population of feral cats than feral dogs. And you studied feral cats in contrast to the domesticated kind.
We actually chose a number of wild cats from the Near East and from Europe, and these were never suspected to be domesticated cats. So unlike feral cats, there are wild cats that have never been part of human populations. And so we did do a comparison between domestic cat breeds and the wild cats, and we didn't see a very large number of differences between the genomes of the domestic cat and those of the wild cat. But we did see a few signals that underlied certain genes that may be related to neural processes. And these are genes that have implications for reward-based learning or fear conditioning. And we think that that might have ultimately allowed domestic cats to become more docile over their process of domestication.
Why do cats retain the streak of independence that they do? Can we boil that down to a question and answer for a scientist like yourself?
It's something we could start to look at with these differences between the genes and how domesticated animals become domesticated. I think that would take more comparative work with other types of animals like the dog.
And what else did you find? You mentioned the wild cats. Is there a name for them? The cats in the Near East, the cats in India, Asia, and of course Mesopotamia, Egypt. Cats were so prized, buried along with leaders very often. What kinds of cats? Tell us more about those that you were studying.
Well, some of the cats we compared different breeds. For instance, we chose six different domestic breeds from around the world, so some of the Eastern cats and also some of the Western or European cats. And then we compared these cat genomes with wild cat genomes. And the wild cats were collected in Israel and Kazakhstan and in Portugal. And so we believe these cats were truly wild cats. And when we did our comparisons between the genomes of the domestic cat and the wild cat, we were looking at genes involved in neural processes that include neurotransmitter signaling and migration of axons. So these are all related to types of activities in the brain, physiological activities. And so this type of discovery creates just additional hypotheses to test. So we can look at gene networks or proteins, the tissues of the brain, the physiology, and ultimately the behavior, which all characterize the biological differences between domestic cats and wild cats.
And all the emotional attachment aside, what does this study of the cat brain in the wild tell us about our own brains, which of course have become terribly domesticated ever since the invention of agriculture?
Well, we can think about other domesticated species first, because all domesticated species exhibit a suite of similar traits, floppy ears or smaller brains or different types of cranial or snout morphology. So domestication itself may select for a few of these similar traits that are encoded by genetic changes, and then these produce the secondary effects of the physiology or the morphology. So by examining patterns across domesticated animals in their genomes, we hope to confirm that different neural networks or genetic networks are targeted again and again over time.
And the genetic networks that are targeted, these have implications for us, obviously.
Well, we all share the same neurons in the DNA that codes for these proteins, so it may very well.
Is it better, would you say, can you put a qualitative difference on that to be wild or domesticated? I mean, certainly feral cats have a much shorter lifespan. You also found that out, and that they really dominate the house cat.
Yes, I mean, those are questions that we seek to explore further. We hope to sequence additional types of wild cats and additional domestic cat breeds. We could look closely at some of the nutrition angles and the morphologies of different breeds. We're really interested in uncovering some of the genes related to certain feline diseases that are comparable to diseases that also affect us.
I just have to play something funny for you. We have a clip here from a cat food ad. This is a recent ad for Blue Buffalo cat food, and it plays upon the house cat's wild ancestry.
It's in their eyes, in their behavior. Your cat and a lynx, it's a shared spirit of the wild. You see, a lynx is your cat's ancestor. They have many similar traits, like a love for meat. That's why there's Blue Wilderness, a meat-rich, grain-free food that satisfies a primitive instinct in every feline.
So, Mike Montague, I don't know, did Blue Buffalo contribute to your research at Washington University in St. Louis?
No, but they certainly nailed the point right on the head. This is a nice ad because cats, we know, are hunters. Often domestic house cats, when they get outside, they'll do a lot of hunting on their own, and they've retained this ability over the process of domestication. We also found specific genes related to metabolizing lipids and fats that seem to be modified over the course of cat evolution that we don't see in other animals. So, yes, cats are known to be hyper-carnivorous. They're always looking for their next meat meal.
How many cats did you study? There's one story of a feral cat chasing a domestic cat through a barn. You folks have stayed up all night, night after night, with tens of thousands of cats for this study, right?
Well, for our study itself, we chose a single cat to sequence the genome from. So this is an Abyssinian cat. It's a type of breed. The cat's name is Cinnamon. And we took a DNA sample from Cinnamon, and then we were able to assemble the genome of the cat that includes all 20 chromosomes. And then we included other domestic cats. So for our study, we included 22 different domestic cats, and we pooled these together and looked at the genomes of those breeds. And we also compared genomes from four different wild cats. So we didn't do a lot of the behavioral work, but it does have implications for looking at the behavior once we have an understanding of the underlying genes within these genomes.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about cats, the science of their behavior, evolution, and history. You can join the conversation. Does this research shed new light on the differences between cats and dogs? Do you think as time goes by that cats might get a little less wild? And we're joined this hour by Mike Montague. He's a researcher at the Genome Institute at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the lead author of a study that analyzed the genome of the domestic cat. And I'd like to bring another voice into the hour. Joining us now from Southampton, England, is John Bradshaw. He is the foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and the author of the book Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. John Bradshaw, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you. We're getting a lot of callers here. I would like to follow on from what we've been speaking with Mike about and talk about our behaviors with cats and their behaviors with us, because that is really what you've been studying as a biologist for the past 30 years.
That's right, yes. I mean, the cat is a really intriguing domestic animal because by strict biological definitions, it's not really domesticated at all, apart from the pedigree animals, because we get our kitties from parents who chose each other, which is very unlike most domestic animals. So there's a big streak of the wild left in the cat, and there's a good reason for that, which is that up until perhaps 50 years ago or so, we really valued that hunting ability that Michael was talking about earlier on. And that's the reason why many people had cats, and still today in many parts of the world, that's the main reason why they have cats. It's not for companionship, it's because they're great hunters. And that's how they became valuable to us. That's why they are now part of human society. And now suddenly we've changed our minds, or many of us in the West have changed our minds about this and want them to be just companions and to give up all that hunting, that past of theirs. And they're not finding it that easy. So genetics, I think, will be the answer to that.
Mm. So a lot of people say, oh, you know, I love my cat, but then he or she brought this dead chipmunk into the house and that wasn't so pleasant. If they're getting fed at home, why do they keep bringing their little kills into the living room?
Well, they have a sort of built-in reason for that, which is if they are a feral cat, for example. I guess people in the United States are familiar with feral cats, which are the same species.
Yeah, I mean, is feral anything outside, or how we define feral?
Feral is any domestic cat that is living a wild lifestyle. So genetically, it will be more or less identical to a domestic cat, and it's quite distinct from say the bobcat or the lynx, which are the American wild cats. Now, over here in Europe and in Asia, we have a different wild cat, Felis silvestris, which is the one that the domestic cat is derived from. And in fact, there's a race of that, Felis silvestris libica, which occurs in the Near East, which the genetic studies have shown or confirmed that that is the genuine wild ancestor. So that's the one that Michael's been talking about, not the sort of feral cats that people are familiar with. But whether it's a feral cat or a wild cat, the food that they catch doesn't actually have that much nourishment in it. So they have to keep hunting. They might have to catch 10 mice a day just to get enough to eat, especially if it's a mother with kittens feeding from her. So it doesn't pay them to stick around and wait till they're hungry before they go hunting. It never has in the past. The ones that had that particular trait would have been a problem, and they would have eventually starved because they would have waited too long before getting the next meal. So it's something that's been built into cats by millions of years of evolution, and because we've encouraged them to hunt for most of the time they've been domesticated, it hasn't yet been bred out of them. And I think this is something that needs to be looked at. Now, a cat that's well fed will hunt less than one that's badly fed. A feral cat will hunt with much more intention, much more seriously than a well fed kitty that, living by the far side. But the fact remains that many of those even well-fed kitties are still have in their minds that hunting is what they were born to do, and so they do it.
John Bradshaw, that's very interesting. Also, I'm wondering, how do cats regard us? I feel like I have some sense of how dogs regard us. I've had both a cat and a dog in my life, and I must say, I think anyone would agree that, we'll let our callers weigh in on this, but that they do treat us differently. How do cats regard humans?
They do indeed treat us very differently. I think they regard us in a similar sort of a way. Dogs are very, very affectionate. I think even dogs, the extent to which they love people has been underestimated in the past. And I think that now that the way that many people train dogs is essentially based around that affection, that the affection is so rewarding, you can train a dog with very little else. Now, you can't train many cats that way. Cats are a territorial animal. Because they're hunting species, they get all their security from the place where they live. They need a secure place to live. So that's why if you move home with your cat, you need to keep it indoors for a while, because the cat takes a while to get used to the idea it's in a new place. A dog will go with you quite happily. A cat will try to get home again, where it sees, what it thinks of as its home, which is the place it used to live in, because that's where they get their security from. So your cat has to have that security of a place to live, and then it can display affection. And they do display affection towards us. They come up to us with their tails raised. That's a sign of friendliness in cats. They purr. They rub themselves around their legs, again, it's a way they use to greet other cats. They sit down next to us and lick our hands. The cats groom each other to show how affectionate they are. So they're showing those signs of affection, but they have to be really relaxed and secure before they'll do it, whereas a dog will do it first and worry about everything else second.
That's very interesting. Well, let's get some callers in on this. David is calling from Woodbury, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, David.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Jane. Oh, gosh, is that your name?
It's fine, David. It's Jackie, but please, welcome.
Jackie. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm muddled. I grew up in a family with we were a dog people, and basically, and they just didn't know about cats. But in my early 20s, at the end of a very quiet party, I was alone in the living room, and feeling quite down, and all of a sudden, a cat came up on my lap, and then I realized about cats. And I have a cat now. She's an indoor cat because I can't stand cats catching boides. But she's very patient with it. And cats just they have empathy very much, and they're in a quiet way. They're very very understanding, and They're very dear.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I'd like to zero in, Michael Montague, on that trait that David mentioned. Do cats, and I'll let you get on this too, please, John Bradshaw, have empathy?
Well, cats display individual behaviors that are unique to individual cats. Some are more skittish, some are more friendly and like to come up and see what's going on with new people in the house. Or imagine, I know some people that own cats, if you bring anything new into the house, the cat would immediately try to figure out what this item is, and if they can jump on it, they'd love to jump up on it and lie on it for a while. So yes, I think cats are unique creatures. They display a range of very, very empathetic behaviors towards other individuals and other cats. So it is fun to watch cats behave with each other.
All right. And anything to add to that, John Bradshaw?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to probe the emotional lives of cats. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, they don't give as much away as dogs do. Dogs, their emotions are written all over their faces and their bodies and their tails. You know, most people can read a dog's body language pretty well. I think cats do identify people who are on their own, and I think that is, or some of them do, I think that's because cats don't like a party very much. They like to interact with people one-to-one. They're not as crazily sociable as dogs are. So if there's a cat, you know, wanting some company, I think it will probably tend to single out the person who is sitting quietly in a corner rather than the people who are moving around and having a very animated conversation. And they are. They may well be being empathetic. It's difficult to tell.
That's interesting. Well, let me explain why I've gotten along perhaps a little bit better with dogs. Let's speak to Nicole. She's calling from Gloucester, Mass. Welcome to On Point, Nicole.
Hi, Jackie. How you doing?
Great.
I have a Bengal cat who is there. I was told that they were less removed from their ancestors, and I wondered how different they were genetically from other domestic house cats. I've had regular domestic house cats. She does some weird stuff. Like, she wants to, like, get in the shower. She's very, like, into water. She likes to get up as high as she possibly can, like, on top of the cabinet. I was just wondering if those were traits that were more dominant in her.
Okay, thank you very much. So is a Bengal, like Nicole's John Bradshaw, closer to a wild species?
It is indeed. In fact, the Bengal is not all domestic cat. If it's a true Bengal, if it's got the leopard spots on the coat, which they characteristically have, that's because those leopard spots have come from a different species called the Asian leopard cat. It occurs in Southeast Asia, doesn't overlap in the wild, so it would never have bred with domestic cats in the wild at all until cats were transported, were taken by us humans, after domestication, down into Southeast Asia. So this was a mating that was done in the United States a few decades ago to start the Bengal line. And all the Bengals still have around 1/16th or 1/32nd of the wild cat, the wild Asian leopard cat, the different species in them. And that comes through very much in their behavior. And they are very unusual, very inquisitive, very, very active. They don't sleep nearly as much as a regular domestic cat does, for example. Very inquisitive, and some of them, not all of them, but some of them can be quite aggressive, quite difficult with other cats. So you have a handful there, I think, your caller.
All right, definitely. Well, and also, I think, a very good answer. Let's take another call. Eleanor is calling from Stowe, Massachusetts.
Hi, Jackie. I just have a quick question. Why do cats like to sit in cardboard boxes? Both my cats do. We have a feral cat who we're trying to befriend in the backyard, and he does. We put a box out for him, and he sits in it all day. And then I've seen pictures of large cats in a zoo sitting in a box.
Okay. Well,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Mike Montague, you want to handle that one?
Well, I imagine there's a sense of security and stability within a confined area where they can feel the safety of not having anything kind of sneaking up behind them or having a kind of exposed back. So that would be my guess.
Okay. Good guess, I think. All right. Trey is calling from Joplin, Missouri. Hello, Trey. I assume that you are calling because you have a cat.
Yes, absolutely. Happy holidays. And I grew up with cats and dogs, and over the last few years become more of a dog person. But my wife and I actually have a Maine Coon, which is the largest breed of domestic cat, I believe, is what I've heard. And I've also heard that they're descendants of American bobcats. So I want to just confirm if that's correct. And I also want to ask a question about their behavior traits. I always thought that maybe they would be more wild, kind of like Bengals or Abyssinians, because of their close descendants of bobcats, what I've heard anyway. But he's actually more social than most cats. Like, when we have people over for parties, he comes out and shows off and flaunts his tail and everything. And he's also not a hunter. We've had a mouse before in the house, and he will get up on the kitchen counter and stare at it.
All right. Okay, so thank you, Trey. So John Bradshaw, cat against type, it seems, likes parties, scared of mice.
Yeah, we have Maine Coons over here in Europe. They're very, very popular. They're lovely cats, as your caller says. They're very large, very long-haired, and generally speaking, very placid, very easygoing. The idea that they have some bobcat blood in them is, I'm afraid, I'm sorry to disappoint you, is a myth. They're actually descended from a European breed, a long-haired breed called the Norwegian Forest Cat, and mixed with, I think, some other cats that were brought over to the eastern United States in the 17th century. And they have been bred, I think, possibly deliberately, to be very laid back, not to be very interested in hunting. And some of them are indeed a little bit timid. I've met one or two that really are quite timid and would not want to squeak back at a mouse, indeed.
All right. Let's try and take a couple of calls. I'll ask people to keep their calls short so we can get them in. Jack is calling from Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to On Point, and keep it brief, please, Jack.
Hi, Jackie. Yeah, real briefly, we got a couple of cats, mother and son, and before the mother was spayed, she was, you know, very protective and loving of her offspring. And the day she got spayed, she turned totally 180 degrees, rebuffed them, pushed them away, very vicious, mean to them. And it's been like that for the last 4 years. The offspring, on the other hand, are very loving and affectionate and turn to her for protection and comfort often. But she rebuffs them every time.
All right.
Is this typical?
Is it typical? Okay, thank you. I think we'll have to let John and Michael have a crack at that without more calls.
Okay, if I may go first, then the mother-son or the mother-offspring thing is quite common, actually. I mean, this is the normal behavior of a feral cat or indeed a wild cat. If they're anywhere where there isn't a whole load of food, once a mother has had her kittens, once they've got to the point where they're a little bit independent, she's going to want to persuade them to move out, because otherwise the whole lot of them are going to starve. And so this is perfectly normal cat behavior in the wild. A mother will tolerate her offspring till they're about 6 months old. And then especially the boys, she will get pretty antagonistic towards them. Now, why this would be triggered by a cat being spayed, I mean, this is possibly just because going to the veterinarian, having an anesthetic, having a big change in the hormones because of the spaying, all of those things will make the animal stressed, make the mother stressed and a little bit more aggressive. So I suspect that's what it was. But it's underneath all of that, it's natural cat behavior.
Okay. And Michael Montague, before we say goodbye to you, just calls that have been coming in referred to that cats like to be with people in nursing homes. That speaks to the isolation that John Bradshaw talked about. Maybe they like quiet. Sometimes cats suckle people, the neck, the sweater, and arm, groom people. Can that happen?
Yes, certainly so. I mean, it's only in the last 200 years that humans have been putting this intense selection pressure on existing cat variation to produce the breeds that we know. And as John mentioned about the Maine Coon, they're known to be very placid and docile animals. And those sorts of behaviors are just as likely to be selected upon by humans as things like fur patterns and pigmentation colors.
Wow. All right. So it's all not an accident. Mike Montague, researcher at the Genome Institute at Washington University in St. Louis, thanks so much for joining us today. And John Bradshaw, foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol and author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We'll be speaking about cats who are friends, but first I'd want to say goodbye to both of you and thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
We're glad to have you. And in the next part of the show, the good luck cat, how a cat saved a family and a family saved a cat. That's a new book out by author Lissa Warren. We'll be hearing more about it, and you can join the conversation. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. Many cat owners and cat lovers will say that their pet is a part of their family. What we're going to hear now is the story of Ting Pei Warren and the family she adopted. Ting Pei is a Corot cat. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. By the way, her story may resonate in your story because she helped with the healing experience when the family suffered the loss of its father. You can join the conversation. Do you think that a cat, any pet, can help someone get through hard times? At the same time, what does it say about us that we go to often extraordinary lengths, as in this case, to save a pet? And joining us now in our studio is Lissa Warren. Her new book is called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Lissa Warren, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jackie. Nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here, and we hope you'll read an excerpt for us before we are done. I don't know if you want to start with that. Well, tell us first a little bit about who is Ting Pei, your cat?
Sure, absolutely. Our family member, you bet. She is a 7-pound Kurat, which is a breed from Thailand, who we adopted 19 years ago. She just celebrated her 19th birthday. We got her as a companion for my father. He had recently retired. My mother was still working. I was working long hours. He needed a companion. So enter Ting, who was mischievous, like many cats are, mellowed in her old age, but throughout was a wonderful, wonderful partner for him. Kept him such great company.
Now, this was not your first cat.
We had had a Burmese previously.
Right. Yep. And you'd had a dog once upon a time. But you did really think carefully about the selection of what kind of cat.
We did. We felt like we had had our Burmese. We didn't want to get another Burmese, even though we loved the breed, because it would have been unfair somehow to the new cat. We would have always compared. So we did a lot of research. We researched many of the breeds that you spoke about earlier this hour, Abyssinians, Maine Coons, Bengals, and really ultimately decided that a Kurat was right for us.
All right. So would you mind reading a little bit from the book? And then, of course, we'll get into this relationship that spans really pivotal parts of your life, given that it has been almost 20 years.
Sure. It's hard to know what to call Ting. The term pet makes her sound somehow lesser than us, lesser than what or who she is. Somehow it belittles her. It's too cutesy. It doesn't do her justice. I've heard people use the term companion animal to describe their dogs and cats. And while in some ways calling her that would be as silly as calling a husband a companion human, it does at least come closer to expressing her place in our lives. It offers a certain respect. It's a nod to what every person who loves cats knows, that life would be much lonelier without them, and that while they weren't put on this planet just to keep us company, they do so with such a skill and devotion that few humans can match, that few humans would even try to. I also like the term companion animal because it sounds reciprocal. As much as Ting is our companion, we are hers. She didn't choose to come here, but she wouldn't choose to leave. This is her home now, and we're her family. We're her companion animals.
Now, I just want to point out here, Lissa, that your family has some assets, I can only call them that, that a lot of cat owners might not have. We were talking the last bit of the segment about cats are really territorial and they like to live in the same place. Your family has, from what I gathered from the book, been in the same house for many, many years.
We have her entire life. Yeah. She has lived in the same house the whole time.
So she hasn't had to move. And you're a small family. It was you, Dad, and Mom.
That's us. That's N-Ting.
N-Ting. Sorry. Forgot about her. So just to trace the arc of this book, she really becomes your dad's cat. Your dad has retired. He has considerable number of health issues at a relatively early age, and they really bond.
Yeah, he had a coronary bypass, and one of the grafts didn't take. And so he was slow. He slept a lot. He still had a lot of mental energy, but not a lot of physical energy. And so having her there with him kept him not just not lonely, but more active than he would have been otherwise, getting down on the floor, playing with her, bending to pick her up. She was physically therapeutic for him in many ways and essential to his mood, his overall mental health.
There's a picture of her here. I realize you just haven't described her. The Kurat can have this gray, you say it's almost a lavender fur in certain lights, and you call her green eyes a lotus leaf color.
Yeah, they are. She is exquisite looking. I mean, the breed is just gorgeous. I think everyone finds their cat beautiful, and I think all cats are beautiful, but gosh, she could model. If they had cat models, she would be one. She is stunning. Her fur almost turns to amethyst in a certain light.
So sketch out why you wrote this book. You're a poet, you're a publisher, you teach. You hadn't published a memoir before. What happens in the arc of the family's life? Health issues become almost everyone's issue.
Yeah, they really did. My father, you know, wasn't well, and eventually he had a massive coronary, and we lost him. And we felt so guilty that we hadn't seen the signs that he was heading into this disaster. But, you know, we had to move on. We had to go on and take care of his cat. And we felt that by taking care of her, we were kind of taking care of him in a way that we had not sufficiently done. Cut to a few years later after my father had passed away, and the cat was diagnosed with second degree AV block, which is a very serious heart condition. We were told that if she was going to survive, she needed a pacemaker, but they don't make pacemakers for cats. So we set about finding her a human pacemaker. Angel Animal Medical Center here in the Boston area was able to fit her with one. And she survived the surgery, had a long recovery, but made it through. And now, even though we couldn't save my father, we could save his cat. And that gives us some peace.
Has anyone ever pushed back on you and said, wow, that's just an extraordinary length to go to for a pet?
Yeah, I have gotten that. And I think especially when you hear the dollar signs involved, some people who don't have cats or just don't understand really think we're crazy. It was $10,000 to get the pacemaker for the cat. And, you know, we're not a wealthy family, but we never once thought of not doing it. I mean, you would do that for your child. And in many ways, that's what she is to us. And so, of course, we would get her whatever medical care she needed that we could possibly scrape together and afford.
And as you write in your book, a lot of this book slows down to almost sort of cat-centric, the cat's pace. You're going through the routines in the cat's day that you interact with. In other words, when she feeds and when she grooms and when she sleeps. And there are times when you don't sleep so that you can watch her.
Yeah, when she first got back from the hospital, my mother and I would take turns being awake with her so that she was never alone. And when we would sleep after she got a little bit better, we would sleep on the floor so that if she got up to go get water or go get food or use the litter box, we would know and we'd be able to watch her and make sure that she was okay. We really don't need clocks in my house. We know what time it is by what time Ting wants the rocker turned so that it's in the sun or what time she wants to eat. We can tell what time it is by the cat.
Wow. And I should say also that you were living with your parents and still live, I guess, with mom.
Yeah.
And therefore the cat clock, if you will. Eventually, it's not just the older parent who's having the health issues, but and your feline, but yourself.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Much to my surprise, I was always that healthy one who, when everyone else got the flu at the office, I didn't get it. I was so healthy, I didn't even have a primary care physician. So I went to a walk-in clinic, and within 24 hours, I had a diagnosis of MS. And I have to say that Ting, the cat, was a wonderful comfort to me during all of that. And I know that no matter what course this disease takes, no matter how bad it gets, I'll always at least be able to take care of a cat. And I'm so grateful for that. The things that are dearest to me, I'll always have.
Let's take a call here. Jean is calling from Spokane, Washington. Welcome to On Point, Jean.
Thank you. I have had a brother-in-law who had a severe Parkinson's. And a lot of what I saw happen with him relates exactly to what your guest is saying. We had a family tragedy and had a family gathering, and it was in my house. And my Abyssinian, Topaz, jumped up into his lap. Why, I don't know. He didn't even like cats. And he began petting her and stroking her, and, of course, she reciprocated and rubbed all over him and stayed there for a long time. And we visibly watched his tremors decrease. And at that stage in his life, he was having trouble walking. I don't know why that immediate interaction changed that kind of behavior or that part of his disease. but it was that time and that time only that everybody in the room took notice of what was happening.
Hmm. All right.
I'll take my answer off the air, but okay. If you have an answer, I'd love to know what it is.
A comment on that, perhaps, Lisa. Thank you, Jean.
Sure. There is something mysteriously medicinal sometimes about cats, and I don't know what it is either, but I think that many people who have cats can absolutely relate to what your caller was saying. They are soothing. They do, studies have shown, lower your blood pressure. They do reduce a person's risk of heart attack, actually, by having a cat, because they have such a soothing and calming effect.
Hmm, that's very interesting. Rose is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Welcome to On Point, Rose.
Thank you. I've been listening to the show and I agree with everything you're saying. I just think that whether it's a cat or any other pet, they just offer so much love. They're just, you know, completely filled with love, and they make sure that you know that at every moment of the day. They're just unconditional. I myself went through 3 knee surgeries, 2 complete knee replacements, didn't have a leg to stand on, and my cat was always there for me, and it just gave me a lot of comfort to know that, you know, no matter what, I was surrounded by someone, something that loved me. And they're more like children. I agree. You just can't turn your back on them when something happens to them. You've got to be there for them, too.
Okay.
So thanks so much for the program.
Thank you, Rose. What about that, Lisa? Cats full of love. I think it's going to have to depend on the cat,
yeah.
Right?
I think it depends on the connection between the cat and their human. And it takes time to develop. I know a lot of people who say, oh, I don't like cats. And I say to them, well, have you ever really, truly known one? And they haven't. And it can take weeks, months, even years to really know a cat and have them truly be comfortable with you. And until then, you don't know what having a cat in your life is all about and what it has to offer.
So I used to be not a cat person. I still would not really call myself one, and got adopted.
Yeah, exactly. You got chosen, right?
Well, she was a little alley cat. I'd been on the road. Tea Lily, we called her. And she came, and I wanted to wait to take her to the cat pound. It was Labor Day weekend. It was closed. And 17 years later, yes.
There you go.
Great reward. She was great. Maggie is calling from Miami, Florida. Welcome to On Point, Maggie.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. The comment I had was that there was a recent video that went viral earlier this year, and there was a cat who saved a little boy when the boy was being attacked by a dog who belonged to a neighbor. And the entire incident was caught on a video camera that the parents had installed outside of the home, and wondered if you had seen it or the guest.
All right.
If you could comment on that.
Thanks, Maggie. And Lissa's nodding her head.
Yeah, I saw it too and watched it again and again and again, and then I tweeted it. So I'm right there with you. It was remarkable. I mean, the cat was, of course, so much smaller than the dog, but threw its entire weight, I mean, flung itself at the dog when the cat thought that the dog was threatening the boy. It is remarkable how loyal they are. And, you know, of course, you think of a dog as you know, a safety net, but cats can be ferocious when their human being is threatened. They absolutely can. I think back to your earlier guests, and you know, it's not just feral cats that can be vicious sometimes. It can be a domesticated cat when their human is in jeopardy.
Yeah. We have time for one more call here. Sophie is calling from Newington, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Sophie.
Oh, yes, Jackie, I'd like to tell you about our Manx cat. My husband was of English heritage and received a blow when he had an illness that would terminate shortly, but they never had any contact for 21 years. And then at the end of their lives, there they are on the bed together, consoling one another. It was absolutely an outstanding experience to see this Manx cat with my husband dying together.
Mm, my goodness, that is an incredible story, Sophie. Thank you so much for sharing that. Well, that's quite a testimony to the feline human companion bond, animal companion.
Yeah, I do think that oftentimes cats can tell when there's something wrong with their human, be it their human being sad or even their human being sick. They do chemically almost seem to be able to sense it. And it does sound like that's what happened in that case.
Have you noticed a change in behavior at home? Now your dad's been gone for some time now. You've had your moments with your own illness. Change in Ting's behavior?
Well, right after my father died, we saw a distinct change in her personality. She started sleeping a whole lot more than she used to. She would wander from room to room. We could only assume that it was looking for him because she had always stayed put when he was alive. She'd stayed put with him. So we absolutely saw those changes. And although, of course, we didn't want the cat to be sad, it gave us a certain amount of comfort that we weren't the only ones grieving the loss of my father. She was right there in it with us.
And as you say, it has helped a great deal. So another year and your cat is still with you?
Yes, she is. She's doing incredibly well.
Well, we're so happy to have that. And any advice for cats over the holidays as we conclude this show?
Sure. One note of caution, watch those ribbons. They like to chew them right off the presents, and it can actually be, you know, quite an injury to them. So keep an eye on the ribbons, but incorporate the cat into all of your family celebrations. Give them a can of tuna. Make something special happen for them this holiday, too.
That sounds like great advice. Lissa Warren, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Lissa Warren's new book is The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. Have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, winter solstice celebration in song. I can only be talking about the revels as they arrive in our studio with carols from A Victorian Christmas. I'm Jackie Lydon, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.